My guest at this time is former U.S. Navy SEAL Carl Higbee, who served twice in Iraq during the War on Terror. He's the author of a new book entitled Battle on the Home Front, A Navy SEAL's Mission to Save the American Dream. His biggest complaint among several against current government policy is what he sees as a very wrong-headed approach to try and win the hearts and minds of folks in Iraq and Afghanistan who have no desire to have their hearts and minds won by what we're trying to instill within them. And he talks about some of the frustrations he's had in training security forces as well. And Carl, thanks so much for being with us.
Hey, thanks for having me on.
When were you in Iraq?
I was in there in 2007 and then again in 2009, both for 7.5, 8 months each time.
And so by the time you were in there, I guess the surge was pretty much underway. What were your responsibilities with the Iraqis?
We had two missions, really. One was basically capture kills on a regular basis in 2007, and then also Foreign International Defense, or FID as we call it, which is to train these people who are incapable of being trained.
And you talk about how there's a significant difference between Bush administration policy and Obama administration policy. Obviously, Obama had just got in there in 2009 during your second tour in Iraq, but what stark differences did you notice?
It was a night-and-day difference of operational tempo. You know, I was there in 2009 again, and that was during the drawdown. And though we had actionable intelligence by every named intelligence agency we could have, our commanders were being pushed down information from all the way up top, saying, you know, risk averse tactics are going to be our best bet. You know, win the hearts and minds, go out and hold hands and play games with these guys. They were under the Obama administration. They were very, very soft-handed about doing anything over there.
What kind of training did you try to do, and what made it largely a useless effort as you see it?
These people are, first off, they're generally not as smart as us. And for people who haven't been there, it's tough to understand, but these people, it's difficult to get them to do basic tasks such as reading a map or doing jumping jacks, and we're giving them guns. So they don't reason like us. They don't think like us. They don't have the same accountability basis as us. They're not capable of learning complex things, especially loyalties to Western democracy.
There's an interesting thing that I read in the materials related to your book about the map. Explain why helping them read a map was so difficult.
They really didn't understand that there was any direction other than east. I tried to explain that, hey, this is north, south, east, and west, which, you know, like imagine which you pray to the east or whatever, and they were like, no. We pray to every direction. And I was like, well, that doesn't make any sense. I thought you prayed to the east. These people did not understand the concept of a cardinal direction. On top of that, I was trying to explain what the map is a view of, and I was explaining it's like if you were a bird flying over, this is what you would see. So they all started flapping their arms. This is all being translated through an American translator who's trained to do this. And so they all started flapping their arms like a bird under the pretense that if they did that, they would see what this map is. It's unfathomable how dumb the people were over there.
Other issues that I've read about here that you mentioned, they were given weapons when you believe they probably shouldn't have been, and then they would just trade them to their neighbors for various things that they thought they needed?
We would have individuals that would come back. One day we'd issue them weapons or trucks or fuel or tools or anything, you know, it was. And they'd come back for training the next day, the next week, and sometimes they wouldn't have what we issued them. We're like, where's your handgun that we gave you last week? Well, my neighbor had a goat, and I wanted the goat, so I gave him the gun. And I was like, you can't just give somebody a firearm that's issued to you. I mean, our tax dollars paid for it, and then we gave it to the Iraqi people, and there is zero accountability of it.
Carl, just last week, of course, we saw the attacks against the U.S. consulate in Benghazi, the riots near the U.S. embassy in Cairo, and one of the stories that's come out, I believe, from the Cairo episode, and I don't know that it's been fully confirmed, but one of the things that was alleged certainly was that our Marines at the embassy were not actually carrying live rounds, and that seems to gel pretty well with something that you observed in Iraq.
Yeah, it's incredible. And first off, this is a problem. They want to tie your hands as soldiers so tightly so they don't have a, quote, incident. And the problem with that is you have Marines like we had there that are ultimately defenseless. You know, they were shooting rubber bullets, I believe, and It's like, why would you send somebody there with a gun without bullets? That's like having a car without gas in the tank.
One of the things we've also heard, of course, as it relates between Iraq and Afghanistan, you mentioned how difficult it was to connect intellectually with the Iraqis. From what we're told, the Iraqi education system is quite a bit ahead of Afghanistan. So even though you haven't been there, how much of a issue do you think that knowledge gap is, especially when we see all these reports of these Afghan soldiers turning their firearms on our own people?
Well, first off, on the firearms thing, why did it take over 50 U.S. soldiers getting killed by partner forces in order for them to even remotely consider changing the policy? That pisses me off to no end, and that is a huge flaw of our leadership. You know, I wouldn't say President Obama, but I'd say in the General Dempsey area that he's a moron for not changing the policy right off the bat. And second, I have friends, a lot of friends who've been to Afghanistan, they come home. They've literally gone into villages and seen these people, and these people don't know who they are. They don't know who Osama bin Laden is. They don't know what America is. They don't know about 9/11. These people are so detached, they don't know that it's past the 14th century sometimes. They're so detached from the modern world that it's impossible to try to impose our society and our reality on them because they're so far detached from it.
What would be your recommendations for folks like the Chairman of the Joint Chiefs, General Dempsey, who you mentioned? Obviously, you're very frustrated with him, but obviously there is civilian control over the military, and so if he doesn't agree with administration policy, they'll find someone who does. So how do you end that cycle?
Stand on your pride. That's what I did, and that's why I was forced to leave the military, because I spoke out against what was wrong. And General Dempsey needs to take a page out of my book and say, hey, President Obama, what you're doing is tying the hands of our guys, and it's getting people killed. He should stand up and say, you know what, we got to either fight to win on our terms or we need to come home, period.
Tell our listeners a little bit about your incident that got you removed from the Navy SEALs.
Actually, I wrote this book, and I submitted it for publication to the proper panels 2 years prior to my publication, as the DOD manual says, and they wouldn't even review it. It was, you know, oh, well, we're not going to look at it. This department doesn't do that. We don't do that. We don't do this. So I said, finally, look, it's been a year and a half from the time I submitted it. I'm just going to publish it. So I published it, and they were like, if you publish this thing, we're going to give you a dishonorable discharge. I was like, all right, whatever. It needs to be said. Went in, published it, and the day after I published it, they gave me the review on it. And I was like, what is going on? They were like, all right, we're going to start this legal process on you. Well, it turns out they didn't do anything legal because they didn't have any grounds for anything. But they ended up forcing me to resign, essentially. I was dumbfounded by the fact that they did that, and the ability to do that, because they took every action they took was administrative. That means non-judicial. So nothing happened in a courtroom. It was all at the word of a commanding officer or a bitter captain above him or something like that.
When you talk about these rules of engagement, your frustrations with it, and you see what's the continuing policy, how do you expect this to unfold, I guess, particularly in Afghanistan, over the next couple of years?
To be honest, I couldn't tell you, because when I did say something, that was one of the things they were bothered about in my book, was like, hey, you know, you can't say that our soldiers aren't allowed to keep bullets in their gun. It makes us look bad. I was like, well, you know what? Then change the policy. Don't yell at me for exposing it, because it's getting guys killed. It needs to be said. It needs to be brought out. So, I mean, judging from that response, I don't think they're going to do anything.
There's another quote that you have here in reaction to a statement from Admiral McCraven. His statement was, we cannot kill our way to victory, and you obviously see that as 180 degrees away from what the policy should be.
Yeah, coming from a military commander, that kind of churns my stomach a little bit, makes me feel a little uneasy about our leaders. But the fact of the matter is, you go back to World War II, where we killed 50 million people, you know, we won the respect of the world. If you eliminate your enemy, there is no more enemy, hence you have won. So I don't know what war college he went to, but the bottom line here is, if you kill some people here and there, you piss off a whole bunch of people. If you go ahead and get the bad guys killed right away and right off the bat, you come on with a strong arm and don't give them any reason to think that they can throw a fast one on you, you win.
Was your life ever in danger in Iraq as a result of these rules of engagement and these policies?
Yes. During the FID, the Foreign International Offense, where we were training these guys, and some Army guys up the road at an adjacent base had been fired upon. One was killed. And these Iraqi soldiers that we were training, they were, you know, in the same boat from the same unit and everything like that. So these guys, we ended up disarming them and at one point and just saying, hey, we're not going to do any firearms training for a while. But as well as that, also the base I was located on was guarded by the Marines that weren't allowed to keep bullets in their gun. So, yeah, every time. I mean, aside from the obvious missions that we went on, we were always in danger from a force protecting us that had their hands tied.
Last question. We're talking with Carl Higbee, ex-Navy SEAL. The book is Battle on the Home Front. What's been the reaction from other veterans of the war, other military people that you've talked to about your book, and what type of experiences have they shared with you?
Higher-ranking individuals, especially officers, hate it because it calls them out for being soft and being spineless and not standing up and putting their career in front of their country. But the sled dogs, the guys who go out and kick in the door, the guys my generation, my rank, similar to that, they all love it. They support it, and they said, you know, I don't agree with everything in it because it's, you know, it's a pretty strong-willed book, but a lot of them agree with a lot of what I said, and they're like, you know, I won't speak out publicly, but thank you for writing this.
Again, the title is Battle on the Home Front, A Navy SEAL's Mission to Save the American Dream. We've been talking with Carl Higbee. Carl, thank you very much for your time today.
Hey, thanks for having me on.
I'm Greg Corumbus, reporting for Radio America.